Before Sandy Stone joined the lesbian separatists at Olivia Records, and before she became a founder of what we now call Trans Studies, before all that, Sandy was a recording engineer in the late 60s at The Record Plant. That is a storied recording studio in New York City, which is still there, and Sandy worked with people like Jimi Hendrix and a slew of others, but after Jimi Hendrix, does it really matter who else I list?
And I had just dropped into the scene from, keep in mind, Annapolis, Maryland. So I was not exactly up to speed with the rate of New York sex. And people like Andy Warhol and the factory and all that were going in and out, and which was even more gender confusing. And so I did not come out of that with any clear idea of who I was. That didn't happen until later.
Sandy eventually moved to California, and it was there that the seeds of what became her essay called The Empire Strikes Back, a Post-Transsexual Manifesto, it was the seeds of that began to take root. This is the document that is often pointed to as a founding document of trans studies. It is the thing that helped to establish trans studies as an academic discipline. And for something written 40 plus years ago, given how much the trans experience has changed since then, it still reads totally modern. Now, today, Sandy Stone is in her late 80s, and just last week, she became the first trans woman ever inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Jeffrey Masters, and this is LGBT Q&A with Sandy Stone. I want to zoom in on your time in California. You know, you left sound engineering, but then found your way back to it here. And it was also this point in your life where you began your transition. You know, this was the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. Like, what resources existed back then for trans people? Like where did you even begin?
There was nothing. As far as I knew, I did find something. After I kind of got myself organized, I went up to San Francisco, opened the San Francisco phone book, kind of threw a dart at the recording studio section, and went to Wally Hyder. And as I had done with the Record Plant, when they opened the door, I said, "I'm the greatest recording engineer in the world." And they said, "Oh yeah, really? Who have you done?" And I said, "Jimi Hendrix." And they said, "Oh, come right in." So there I was, back in big time recording, and living in this little dump in the Tenderloin. And it was at that point that I said, all right, you really have to face a bunch of stuff in your life. Who are you? Who the hell are you? And what are you doing here? So I began to look around. And what do? I mean, Google is the Yellow Pages. So when you're living in the Tenderloin, It's fairly easy to find out stuff about what would now be called LGBTQ+. They directed, whoever it was I talked to, directed me to the Mattachine Society, which at that time was what we would consider a very conservative organization. And one day I said, I have to do this. And I picked up the phone and I called Mattachine. Because of Christine Jorgensen, I knew the word transsexual. That was about it. And I said, I think I'm transsexual. Can you give me any advice? And they said, no, we don't do anything like that. But why don't you try Daughters of Bilitis? And I said, okay. So I called Daughters of Bilitis. They said, oh, we don't do anything like that. We don't know anything about that. But have you thought of calling the police? And I said, have I what?
Yeah, what?
Well, it turns out that the police had an outreach arm in the Tenderloin called the Transsexual Counseling Unit, TCU, which was doing outreach to anybody in the Tenderloin who presented like that.
That sounds unbelievable.
It was. It was run by one cop, Elliot Blackstone, who was on the local beat and was not happy with the abuse that the queens in the Tenderloin were getting, because the cops would beat the shit out of anybody who looked sexually ambiguous. And Elliot wanted to help them, so he was trying to figure out how to provide some kind of resource structure. It wasn't much, it wasn't very good, but it was something.
And this is like the mid-70s?
No, late 60s, early 70s.
Wow. So late 60s, early 70s. Yeah, I guess I'm just thinking like how like incredible it is to have like even like one person to be like, no, like transsexual back then like is okay. Like it sounds like he had a positive like view of trans people.
He had a sympathetic view. In talking with him, it became clear to me that he really didn't understand anything about it or why people were doing it or anything like that. And he had cop mentality and cop manner, you know, so he would say, you know, you got to think of these people are kind of, you know, they want operation. They want operations on the hands, operations on the feet. And you got to think about what you're doing. It was kind of like that, but he had a big heart. He didn't like to see people being hurt. And so I went over there and their intake person, this was a stroke of genius on Elliot's part. Their intake person, the person who ran the front office, was a trans woman. Her name was Janice Maxwell, who was rather unaffectionately known as Jansy the Transy. And Jan was an ex-con numerous times, and she was totally psychotic. And she looked at me as if I were some sort of cancerous growth. And she said, so you think you're transsexual. Okay, so let me set the scene here. I have a huge beard. You know, I've got my black beard. I've got my Jufro. I'm wearing a work shirt, jeans, engineer's boots. So Jan, from her point of view, is actually correct. I'm not walking the walk at all. But I say something like, I'm exploring. I want to know what this is about. I want to know if I am or not. And I'm here to get help. And that kind of threw Jan off her stride for a minute. And she said, well, let me show you something. And she took me out on the street and down the block and into some sort of row house. We went down a bunch of stairs into one of the lower levels, and there were red light bulbs in the ceiling. So it was like descending into hell with Dante as your guide, with Jan going in front of me. And we get down there, and there are these trans women down there. They didn't have much in their lives to start with, but they were trans. And they did things like get electrolysis partly and then run out of money, or surgeries were primitive and there was a first stage, second stage, and then they would run out of money. So there were people down there who were caught in not in being what we would call ambiguous, but in something far worse, because they were scarred and couldn't get a job and didn't qualify for assistance because assistance was cruel at that time. And there were people who they simply didn't want to service. Jan showed me several rooms of people like this. And I think she was trying to scare me straight, quote unquote. But I was getting angry. After the third house, I said, why are you showing me this? Why aren't you helping these people? And she said, nobody's going to help these people. And I said, well, why are you showing me this then? And she said, because this is what you're going to be. Okay. That makes your blood run a little cold.
Yeah, that description, I mean, it's really like heartbreaking hearing about all that. It's also like so like layered that this was like another trans person like saying this to you, mm-hmm. like you're going to end up like this. Like, was she trying to, I mean, it sounds like she was trying to talk you out
yes,
of it.
That's exactly what she was trying to do. She knew what the odds were. She knew what happened to most of the people in her ambit. But of course, that was her ambit.
I mean, and so like, at what point did you like finally meet other trans women that were like affirming and not trying to like scare you out of like being trans?
That would have been several years later. So I had heard about Stanford at this point. And all I knew about Stanford was they were the most restrictive program around. They wanted women who were slim and small and blonde and liked to wear high heels and dresses. Okay, very stereotypical. I thought, hot damn, this is perfect for me. If I can overcome those obstacles, then I know I'm real. So I went up there and I met Don Laub and Don said, can I help you? And I said, I'm interested in transitioning. And Don said, to what? And
oh my God.
Don and I became good friends after a while. And we argued a lot about what woman meant, because Don was really in the game to help people. He really wanted to help and he wanted to learn. And he said, you realize what you have to do. You have to live full time, 24 hours a day. Da, 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 da. I said, okay, I'll do that. And Don said, and come back in a year. I said, okay, I'll see you in a year. And I went off. And it was all a very strange, interesting time of sleight of hand, prestidigitation, a certain amount of hiding, because I'm still in mainstream rock recording. And in the meantime, I'm growing breasts and I'm wearing looser and looser shirts.
Oh, funny.
Anyway, I dropped out of the mainstream recording scene. I dropped out of recording altogether. I disappeared. I came out publicly. This is 1974. And I began my life as a woman, pre-op, doing my year before Stanford could approve me. And that's when I met the women from Olivia.
Yes.
And went off on that adventure.
Okay, so with Olivia, that's Olivia Records. Can you just explain and give a brief summary about what Olivia was? Because it's a bit more complex than just saying that it was a job at a record company.
Olivia was a women's record company, which is to say it was created to release and record music specifically by women musicians entirely. And it was staffed and run entirely by women, all women.
So maybe I got my facts wrong, but I thought it was all lesbians.
It was, okay, Olivia was a lesbian separatist record company. We specifically did not want to work with male musicians. And in fact, we avoided them at all costs. We wanted to promote, to feature, to advance the cause of women musicians. And we did.
So you're working together, you're also living together because it was a collective. I mean, like just 24/7 together. Did you enjoy that?
I loved it. I think we all liked it because we all chose it. I mean, nobody had to do it. They came because they liked the idea and thought that it would be fun, productive, whatever. And actually being in the presence of a dedicated group of women with a single overarching purpose that everyone has signed on to with all their hearts, that's actually a very, very nice experience.
Was there like dating and relationships going on too?
There were. A few of the women were sleeping with each other. But not everybody was sleeping with everyone. It felt like just a normal percentage of interactions. And of course, Meg, in the middle of what else we were doing, Meg and Holly fell in love. So that was a whole other thing.
Oh, right. Both are famous singers. Meg Christian, though, is one of the Olivia co-founders and known for singing Ode to a Gym Teacher, which is a gargantuan lesbian classic. But it is while you were working at Olivia in 1979 when Janice Raymond publishes the book called The Transsexual Empire, The Making of the She-Male, mm-hmm. which is anti-trans, as people can assume by the name. But I don't think that book is remembered in any way today. How big was it, and how big of a splash did it make at the time?
Well, I think if you were a person holding down a 9-to-5 in Minneapolis, you probably never heard of Janice Raymond, and you never would. If you were a lesbian separatist in Los Angeles, California, you probably heard nothing else. So it depended on where you were. And also, Janice Raymond, for whatever reason, became a spokesperson for transphobia during Senate hearings about various laws in Washington, D.C. But Raymond claimed to be an authoritative source. She was published by an authoritative publisher. She had everything going for her. So congressional groups would call her in as an expert to testify. And her line was, transgender is sick. It's a sickness. It's morally corrupt and needs to be stamped out.
And so Janice Raymond, in the book, The Transsexual Empire, she actually calls you out mm-hmm. by name. What was your reaction when you found that out?
I think it would be fair to say my reaction was, holy shit, who does she think she is? It was cruel.
Yeah.
It was unethical. It was extremely unethical. It was cruelty for the sake of cruelty. It could only bring harm to me by doing that. And Raymond had no, because Raymond did not see me as a human being, it did not occur to her that there might be moral consequences to what she was doing.
And there were a lot of big consequences, like for you in your life. Olivia got a lot of hate mail, but also it eventually all culminated in a big like community town hall meeting to discuss this. What was the stated purpose of that meeting?
We received word that a group of women wanted to meet with us to talk about the trans issue and other beefs they had with Olivia. And that meeting was held in a room over a bookstore in Oakland, California. And we went up there totally naively expecting that we would have dialogue. When we got into the room and everyone sat down, my memory was there were about 30 other women. And one of the women from the Chicago group got up to introduce the meeting. And she made perfectly deadpan a long opening speech about how, of course, we all knew trans women were really men and they were really rapists and they really destroyed women's community. And actually everyone knew how they had no place in the women's community, and of course, we should be driving them out, and on like that. And the collective sat there with our jaws dropping. We had no idea. I don't know what we thought was going to happen, but not that. And after the other person ran down and sat down, everybody turned around and looked at me. And I made the mistake of saying the first thing that came into my head, which was, well, that's all bullshit. And the room just erupted. It exploded. There were women screaming at us.
Wait, why is that a mistake?
Because I did not respond in a sister, woman, friend manner. I made a rough, intrusive male remark. I said, that's all bullshit. And no real woman would ever do that.
Huh.
According to our opposition. So there I am, having done the exact wrong thing, quote unquote.
So I guess what I'm like confused by is like, this is like public meeting to discuss like someone's job at a private company, more or less.
Well, that is the correct way to look at it, but it's not the emotional way. The emotional way was that they had hired a man, possibly a rapist, who was going to disrupt them, divide true women, and he needed to be gotten rid of in any way necessary.
It's pretty striking that this, like, trans women are rapists thing that they're repeating is, like, the exact same thing we're hearing, like, today, more or less, too, like, with, like, trans people in bathrooms and everything, like, 50, 60 years later.
These arguments come from women who are, for whatever reason, deeply wounded, damaged in some way, and they express their wounding or their damage onto someone or something that they see as a symbol of their hurt and is in some way therefore responsible for it. Therefore, if a woman has at some point in their lives been traumatized by a man, as almost every woman has, then a trans woman becomes a very powerful symbol of that.
Janice Raymond herself is a lesbian. Did it hurt more coming from another queer person?
That was merely a cherry on the sundae. I mean, it was also coming from a nun. You have to think about that for a while.
She was a nun?
She was a nun. Oh. Not at that time. She had left the cloister. But Janice Raymond had been a nun.
Wow.
And there was a certain amount of evidence that she had had a love affair with a trans woman that ended badly. And that a certain amount of what she was doing was revenge. This is not sinful. But there you are.
And I mean, one of the reasons we're like talking about this part of your life is because it eventually led you to write a response called The Empire Strikes Back, a Post-Transsexual Manifesto. And this is considered a founding document of trans studies. The manifesto was published in 1987. Janice Raymond's book was published in 79. So this is 8 years after her book. Was it something that was still having like an effect, an impact on your life like that?
Oh, absolutely. It was brought up at every opportunity when some transgender question came up, either medically or legally or something like that. Not necessarily in my personal life, but Janice Raymond's tentacles extended far.
So much of the trans experience and how we like understand and think about being trans has changed over the recent years. And what stands out to me in the manifesto you wrote is how like relevant so much of it still is. It's not outdated. Like, is that how you were thinking about, or I guess what my question is, was how you were thinking about transness back then, did that feel unique at that time?
Yes. There was very little literature available. There was no critical literature. There was nothing that I would call deep studies. I mean, I'm looking over at a book that happens to be sitting on the edge of my shelf right now. A current book at that time was Green and Monies, which is this horrible mess of misinformation. And it was one of the only medico-psychological official books available at the time. Here it is. This is one of the only authoritative books on the topic at the time. And they've both been largely discredited, but that's what was in the air at the time. I'm writing against people like Green and Money and Janice Raymond, and unfortunately, I'm writing against people like Christine Jorgensen and the pseudo-authors of Lily Elbe's so-called autobiography. Anyway, there was nothing out there. I could have picked from any of those to deconstruct, and I did.
Well, one of the things you deconstruct is that you urge us to move away from this like surgery-focused formulation of trans identity. And it took a while, but I think we've like largely got there now.
I think so. Yeah. We have. The transphobes haven't. They're still focused on surgery. And that, fortunately, you know, we're now at a point where that says so much about them. That says so much about a transphobe's pathological focus on genitalia. And it's about time that people with professional status in the medical world and the psychological world started asking hard questions about why these people are so focused on genitalia when most trans people are not.
Yeah.
Why is this such a, oh my God, they're cutting their whatever? Do we have to go all the way back to Freud? I mean, is it that stupid?
The other like aspect that really stands out, I think, again, like now and like our current time is like you're writing about the gender binary and like moving away from it and how constricting it can be. You know, you were writing this, just for to let everyone know, you're writing this like years before the non-binary experience got anywhere close to like the mainstream visibility it has today. And clearly this is something like you were thinking about even then.
Yeah. I was thinking about all these things because I had to, because I kept getting nailed to the wall by everything and everybody that was going on. And that tends to make you think fast. And also, I wanted to know why. Why is something that just feels like a natural step in my trying to become who I am, get that fight behind me, and just be able to live my life? Why is this so loaded for everybody around me?
Well, along those lines, you know, it's a weird time because the trans community has made momentous strides, and yet at the same time, they're also under like direct, very serious attacks.
Yeah.
Like, why do you think that like backlash is happening? Like, why we're seeing that now?
Well, we're making strides, but that doesn't mean that the transphobes are making any strides at all. They're operating in a very reflexive neuromuscular loop, if you will, using that in a symbolic sense. They're going, ouch, I'm hurt, and I'm going to bite you. We're advancing because we are learning. We're benefiting from what we learn. And we're using that knowledge to teach other people. How can we live better and live better in relation to people around us? But there are wounded people around us who don't care about any of that and will not and never will. They're just going, I hurt and I'm going to bite you. They always have. And there's no reason for them to grow. There's no motivation to grow. There's nothing in it for them.
At what point did you meet your partner, Sinbi?
After I got headhunted to the University of Texas at Austin, and my students set up a mailing list for rather more mature researchers who were interested in the idea of how computer code can create community. How, by writing computer code, can we enable better kinds of social interaction? This was a lot more salient in the 1980s, 90s than it is now. And it was a very hot topic.
Yeah.
So here we are on this mailing list. Nobody knows anybody else. And we're going around introducing each other. And this person who calls themselves Sinbi puts up this brilliant post about anthropology of particle physics and a bunch of other electronics and philosophy and all jammed into one post. And my eyes popped out. It was freaking brilliant. And first I wrote back a response.
And this is just a stranger on the internet, not a student, right?
No, this is a perfect stranger. I have no idea who they are. I have no idea what they are. All I know is they're on a mailing list with me. And we begin writing to each other back channel. And we exchange a bunch of letters. And we're both geeks. And we're both crazy in similar or complementary ways. And we're both really deep into code and community and particle physics and, you know, this whole stew of stuff that geeks do. But we're having this wonderful romantic online life. Two geeks just getting to know each other, and it unfolds into a whole reality. Everything fit.
Wow. At that time, you were identifying, I believe, still as a lesbian.
A lesbian, like, separatist.
Like, what was going through your mind, like falling in... Yeah, lesbian separatist. So what's going through your mind, like, finding yourself falling in love with a man?
That was exactly what I was thinking. Stone, what are you doing falling in love with a man? This is against everything you stand for. But it's so sweet. We played a lot with the idea of man-woman just for fun, for the fun of it. I don't think either of us had ever anticipated having anything that dyadic happen in our lives. And I personally had no rational explanation for it. And I still don't, except for the fact that it was so sweet. It just worked.
Wow.
We were together for the next 20 years. It was just absolutely wonderful. It was never anything less than wonderful in every way.
Can I ask, how long has he been gone for?
He died in 2016. So 7 years. It changed both of us. It certainly changed me. And it continues to change me, because I continue to look back at things that Sinbi would have done or said as models for things to do now.
You mentioned, like, the fun you would have, the two of you, with, like, gender.
Yeah.
How has your experience of gender evolved as you've gotten older?
It's become more fluid. I don't have great stakes in one gender position or another, even though my default appears to be, you know, trans woman. Usually in any social situation, I'm automatically addressed as ma'am. So I know I'm giving off ma'am vibes, which is fine from my point of view. Obviously, I'm comfortable there. But I originally described gender as a boat adrift in a sea of possibilities, and I tend to talk about gender now as an n-dimensional matrix, which is maybe putting a little more abstract mathematical hit on it, but they're different aspects of the same thing. They're the idea of identity as a position in an emotional field. Well, one dimension is emotional, another dimension is social, another dimension is physical, another dimension is historic, another dimension is ethnic. I mean, you could go on doing that for a long time, building your identity matrix, and each one of those points is an n-dimensional vector in that space. So I'm doing that kind of in this conscious, critical, theoretical way. Kids are doing it in this totally unconscious way because many of them have just absorbed it and they can now do it and it feels good. So however you want to see that, that's how I do it.
So last question, but in the Post-Transsexual Manifesto, you wrote, and this was 1987, you wrote in the very last line of it, "Perhaps it's time to begin laying the groundwork for the next transformation." That next transformation, do you think that we are living in that now, or is it something we still have not like gotten to and achieved?
I think we've gotten through it, and we're now on to the next one. And the first transformation was around the time transgender studies became a thing. Not because transgender studies became a thing, but because it's becoming a thing was a visible manifestation of the beginning of that transformation in, I would say, Western society. Trans, for a little while there before the backlash started, about the time I think Time had the transgender gender tipping point cover. At that point, we had moved into something else. Lots of people will define it differently, but that was that moment. And then starts the pushback. So at that point, we've gone 10 steps forward. Now we're going to have our noses rubbed into going 5 steps back. And the end of that will be that we're 5 steps forward. So then we go to the next transformation. And we're in another one now, and I'm not quite sure what it is yet. But we laid the groundwork for the first one. That one was pretty good. Now we have to lay the groundwork for the next one, or the one after that.
Yeah. I think that's an amazing place to leave it. Thank you for spending so much time with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for asking such good questions.
And that is the great Sandy Stone. I should say, too, there is currently a documentary about Sandy that's in the works. And if you want to learn more about that, it is called Girl Island. And their website is girlislandfilm.com. We also have a link to their site in our show notes if you want to check that out. And also in our show notes is a link to our Substack. That is the best way to support our work. And honestly, we could not do this thing without you. I say we, but really, it's just me. Hi, Jeffrey Masters. You know, this last season took about a year to produce, and I'm hoping the next one can come out even sooner next time. So if you're able to contribute to help make sure this podcast can continue, and I hope you do, you can do that on our Substack. A link to that is in our show notes. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much to everyone who has joined us there. Then next week, we are back with a two-spirit elder from Canada. That is the activist and artist, Mani Jacobe. I hope you'll listen. All right, bye.